Now, before we go into the significance of the symbols contained within this mantra and the general meaning of the mantra, I'm going to read this week's parable. It has no title in the original, but perhaps we could call it the parable of the drunkard and the jewel. And as I've already said, the meaning of this parable is identical with that of the mantra itself. It occurs in chapter 8 of the White Lotus Sutra. Now, how does this sutra begin? Let's go into this a little bit first. First of all, in this chapter, the Buddha predicts to supreme enlightenment his disciple Purna. Now, we find among the disciples of the Buddha, especially the chief disciples, of whom there were 64, certain disciples were outstanding for particular qualities, not to say qualifications. And it so happened that Purna, among all the disciples of the Buddha, was the greatest speaker, the greatest preacher, and he was famous for his eloquence. So in this particular chapter, the Buddha declares that Purna, in the distant future, will become a Buddha, and his name will be, then, a Radiance of the Truth. Now, you may remember that in previous chapters, other disciples have been predicted to supreme enlightenment in the distant future, and different worlds, as it were, assigned to them, some of them unthinkably remote from our own. But in the case of Purna's prediction, there's a difference. He too, the Buddha says, will become a Buddha in the distant future. But he'll not become a Buddha, he says, in some other world remote from ours. He will become a Buddha in this very world itself, millions and millions of years ahead. But it seems, from what the Buddha goes on to say, that in those days this world will be a very different place from what it is now. It will have undergone considerable changes, so much so it will have become what is called, technically, a pure world, a world free from certain imperfections, if you like, an ideal world. It will have become very, very much better. And this is surely a very encouraging thought, that if not in our lifetimes, at least in several millions of years' time, this world will have become an almost perfect place. Now, the Indian Buddhist tradition has its own ideas as to what constitutes perfection so far as a world is concerned. And the sutra says, in the first place, the whole world will be perfectly flat. The Indians, including the Indian Buddhists, for some reason or other, had an objection to any irregularity of the earth's surface. They apparently thought it was untidy and unaesthetic, having all these mountains and hills all over the place, breaking up the beautiful smooth contours of the horizon. So in those days, in millions of years' time, everything will have been worn flat. And I believe this is even geologically possible, that all the mountains will be made flat, and all the hollows will be filled up, and the whole world will just be flat like the top of a table. But the sutra doesn't stop there. It says that the world will not only be made flat, but it'll be transformed. It'll hardly be recognizable. It won't be made up of things like earth and stone and so on. It'll be made up entirely of the seven precious things. In those distant days, the whole earth will be made of gold and silver, crystal, etc. And there'll also be many buildings. And the buildings too, the sutra says, will also be made of the seven precious things, gold, silver, crystal, and so on. And he also goes on to say, and this is a very interesting feature indeed, for some people at least, the sutra says that in those days, divine vehicles will be stationed in the sky. This has a rather familiar ring. And not only that, but it says that the entire division between the world of men and the world of the gods will be abolished, will be broken down. There'll be no barrier between the ordinary human world and the world of the gods, or what we might call the archetypal realm. Human beings on the earth will look up and be able to see the gods, and the gods in the heavens looking down will be able to see human beings. There'll be this sort of regular contact and intercourse between them. And also the sutra goes on to say that in those days there will be in the world no places of suffering, not even the sound of any torment or distress. And it also goes on to say that in those days, in the world, there will be no women. I hope the Women's Liberation isn't listening. But this, of course, doesn't mean that the world will contain men, but not women. It really means that there will be no distinction of sex among the beings of the earth in those days. In a sense, neither men nor women, just human beings. And beings, it says, will be born or reborn by what is called apparitional birth. None of the present rather crude arrangements. People will just sort of spring into existence, sort of blossom naturally out of thin air, as it were. And having been born in that way, it's not surprising that they'll lead, according to the sutra, a purely spiritual life. They'll have no gross physical bodies. They'll have what are called mental bodies, spiritual bodies, and they'll all be self-luminous, brilliant. And they'll be able to fly through the air at will. And because they don't have gross material bodies, they won't have any need for gross material food. The sutra says they'll feed on only two things. They'll feed on delight in the Buddha's teaching and delight in meditation. And of course in those days, as isn't surprising under those circumstances, there will be many, many bodhisattvas. And not only that, at a sort of crowning touch, the sutra says, and there will be many stupas, all made of the seven precious things.